The passing of the years brought international fame, leading to the unique semantic situation in which a man's proper name came to be accepted as a verb. Thus, the status-seeking tycoon of industry who boasted to a friend, "I've just been karshed." Well, now, let's all sit back for about an hour and a half, and be karshed, or at least Yusufed. In the time-honored tradition of the photographers, we invite you to say smile, say cheese, and say welcome to a great international talent who makes his home in Canada, Yusuf Karsh.
This is not needed now, perhaps.
Well, I think you can use it as your turn.
Mr. President, Stuart and Letha Keith, distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, I have always believed that every second living person was a potential photographer. And tonight I'm convinced of that. So I thank you, Mr. President, for the honor of your invitation and the warmth of your welcome. My presentation will be considered in three stages. With your indulgence, I will read the first phase of it, then we'll view the slides and comment on them, and happily there will be questions and answers. But above all, I find it so comforting for me to come and be greeted by all the friends from my first home in Sherbrooke and so many friends from Ottawa. And to speak of Ottawa, I feel it's very good to leave the snow and political election blizzard to come and be greeted by the snowdrops and the blizzard of crocuses of Vancouver. I was born within a day's walk of the place which some archaeologists and all Armenians believe was the biblical Garden of Eden. All I know is that perhaps I was born so close to that lost paradise, I have always disliked snakes and avoided apples. But however complex my feelings for the life I left behind me as a 16-year-old immigrant, certainly my every thought about the new world since that time has been colored by a deep and overwhelming sense of gratitude. For it is in Canada that I first experienced the sunshine of freedom. In the old world, my mother taught me not to hate. I recall when I was at the age of 6 or 7, leaving our constantly interfered with and interrupted schools, on my way from home, Turkish children of equal age or older would try to stop us to search our pockets. What could we have in them? Nothing but a few marbles. On one occasion, I resisted their search, and consequently, they threw a stone at me and hit me on the forehead. I arrived home to my mother bleeding and defiant, and I told my mother, "Wait, those boys will never do this again to me, for I will be the one who will carry the stones from now on, and the first sign of aggression from them, I will hit them so they will never forget it." My mother took me closer to her and said, "Son, do you really think they know what they are doing? However, if you have to retaliate in self-defense, be sure you miss." My first desire was to be a physician. But this was not to be. I was poor, but I was always interested in people, and it was this interest which led me to the choice of photography as a profession. I first became interested in photography when my uncle Nakash gave me a Brownie camera. A schoolmate of mine, I presented him with a photograph, and unbeknown to me, he entered it in a competition and it won a first prize. Sometimes on such a seemingly trivial incident, a career, the work of one's life is launched. But it was not until I served my apprenticeships with one of the most remarkable photographers of his day, John H. Garrow of Boston, that I realized photography and medicine were both related, both involved people, and portrait photography in particular involved people on a very personal level. In Garrow's studio for three formative, exciting years, I received an education in human relations as well as the technical aspects of photography. Since my apprenticeship took place during the days of Prohibition, I not only became proficient in the art of mixing hypo, but also synthetic rye, gin, and artificially flavored whiskey with alcohol, which was delivered to the studio in innocent-looking paint cans. There was not a day when some of the outstanding men and women in the arts and letters, in music and the opera and the theater, did not pay a call on Garrow. Every day at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, all work would stop in the studio and Garrow would receive his visitors. As his distinguished guest came to pay court to Garrow, he might say, "Yusuf, give Dr. Kudzewski his favorite drink, nitric acid." In the midst of hard work and gay diversion of Prohibition, as I observed Garrow's fascinating guests and as I responded to their personalities, I gradually came to realize that photography in general and portrait photography in particular was capable of furnishing me with immense satisfaction. To me, a human face was a mirror in which, from moment to moment, the subtlest of emotions was reflected. If I could search out and capture on film and perpetuate for all time those people who influence our lives and make the world what it is today, then I knew I would find my role in photography. When my apprenticeship days were over, I chose Ottawa as the place where I would set up my first studio because, as the nation's capital, it was a crossroads. During this early part of my career, I became keenly interested in the work of the Ottawa Little Theater, an enthusiastic group of amateur players who took their work seriously. The gifted young man who often took the role of Hamlet or Romeo was Lord Duncannon, son of the then Governor General of Canada, Lord Bessborough. I prevailed upon Lord Duncannon if he would persuade his parents to honor me by being photographed. Within a few weeks, this was made possible, and Lord and Lady Bessborough arrived at my studio. Very bemedaled and bejeweled, protocol demanded that you photograph the man first, because he was the representative of the king in Ottawa. He was in Windsor uniform, decoration, sword, and all. And having worked with great concern and anxiety for some half hour, I found myself inviting Lord Bessborough, "Your Excellency, will you please recline with my secretary in the office while I photograph your lady?" That word retire eluded me, but completely. Some years after, I told that to my wife, Esrita. I said, "I used to make so many faux pas that was really very embarrassing." But she said, I have news for you, you still make them. For recently, you wrote me a very considerate, very thoughtful letter from Rome. And you concluded your letter as follows. I long to hold you in my arms and embarrass you. When I enter my studio today, I sometimes think of my original desire to be a doctor. When I say my studio, I mean more accurately any room in the world into which I bring my portable lights and camera. For I do very little work in an actual photographic studio. If possible, I prefer to photograph my subject in a place familiar to him. And whether I happen to be in Finland, Germany, or Italy, or Switzerland, or France, the relationship between the photographer and the sitter must be a close and intimate one, not altogether unlike that of a physician and patient. For the photographer with understanding, the sitter will be as confident as a patient who tells his problems in a trusted doctor's consultation room. Ideally, it is a delicate atmosphere of uninhibited closeness which a portrait sitting must develop between the two on both sides of the camera. I know of no excitement equal to the enjoyment of meeting someone interesting and forceful who has helped to make this age so fascinating, many say the most fascinating in history. When your eyes meet those of your fellow man with sincerity, dedication, understanding, there is no language barrier. But how do I go about my work so that hopefully there will be a meeting of minds? I prepare myself in advance with as much information as possible about each person I photograph, be they famous or unknown. I do not rely on a few minutes conversation with the subject to form an impression of the man and his accomplishments. Well in advance of the sitting, I read about him. I search for stories, his favorite hobbies, his chief interests in order to get a well-rounded picture of my sitter. But facts and figures are merely the skeleton upon which is built a living personality. In the space of the time of our meeting, and this ranges from half a minute with General de Gaulle, to 4.5 hours with Nikita Khrushchev, to 2 days each with Pablo Casal, Jan Sibelius, and Albert Schweitzer. I attempt to produce an image of my sitter which is true, not merely of the fleeting moment, but hopefully of this man's inner life. I try to produce a photograph which will synthesize his past, his present, and perhaps something of his future. Experience has sharpened what may be that special sense, that intuitive perception with which all photographers must be born or must cultivate. It registers in a fraction of a second and with tremendous focal depth the inward power of greatness. When that appears before my camera in an arrested moment, I hope I may recognize it in a flash. There is a brief moment when all that there is in a man's mind, soul, and spirit is reflected through his eyes, his hand, his attitude. This is the moment to record. Often there is one quality in my sitter which stands out as though it were written on his forehead. I think back over the serene wisdom which came from the eyes of Albert Einstein. A unique combination of greatness and goodness. And the grand face of Sibelius as he greeted me at the door of his home in Finland. And the ascetic magnetism of underwater explorer Jacques Cousteau. I have often been asked, does a person's face really reflect his true personality? This is an absorbing question. I have sometimes had conflicting impression of someone upon first meeting him, and then later changed my original ideas before I photographed him. For example, Ernest Hemingway, upon first glimpse, looked like a rugged outdoor man, but he turned out to be the shyest man I have ever photographed. When I first met Dag Hammarskjöld, I felt he put an emotional distance between himself and me during the first minutes of our conversation. But as I grew aware of the extreme complexity of his personality and the richness of his character, I began to see beyond the mask of the correct diplomat of the United Nations. Hammarskjöld himself turned from the role of the initially aloof subject to that of an interested, cooperative participant in our photographic session. In a sense, a face can belie a personality. What people think, what they say, how they react, the quality of their voices, these are some of the things which impress me and help me to portray that personality. All men, no matter how great, are not great 24 hours a day. And great personalities do not always yield great photographs. If genius is 98% ordinary, then it is the task of the man behind the camera to bring out the glorious 2%. We recognize the giants of history through the impact of their accomplishments, whether they be philosophical, political, literary, or artistic. Man has always visualized historical figures. Even when no true likeness existed, man has been willing to accept standardized interpretation of what they might have looked like, as with Jesus or Buddha. Today, the superficial faces of world leaders come to us with our daily newspapers on the 11 o'clock news, and it seems the more familiar the outward visage, the more elusive their inner spirit. We want to know the inner motivation of these leaders who are influencing our destinies. What are they really like? I know this to be true because of the kind of interest my one-man exhibition, Men Who Make Our World, is generating in many parts of the world. People spend long periods contemplating the portraits as if seeking to plumb their very depths. At one of these exhibitions, an old man was looking at my portraits of Casals, showing him photographed from the back, bent over his beloved cello playing Bach. And when this man was asked what he saw in this photograph that he gazed at it so long, his reply was, "Shh, you're interrupting me, I'm listening to the music." I have often been asked, what do all these great people have in common? First of all, they have an immense belief in themselves and their mission. They have determination, intuition, and integrity, as well as the ability to work hard. Great men have something inside of them, a fire, a furnace, a burning, especially at the crucial moment of decision. Great men draw on accumulated wisdom of their life's experiences. Great men are often lonely, but perhaps that loneliness is part of their ability to create. For it has been said that character, like photographic films, develops in darkness. In the last 40 odd years since I opened my original studio in Ottawa, I have watched photography become an acknowledged art, taking its rightful place in the museums and galleries of the world. I have seen the photographer himself become a modern folk hero, bringing romance and social consciousness with his camera lens. More important, schools and colleges business organizations, major museums, and libraries throughout the world are devoting a good deal of their programs and important gallery space to exhibit, enlighten, and educate through photography. It is equally gratifying to know how many interested men and women collect photographic prints for their own enjoyment and with avid enthusiasm. It has been said that the camera is an easy tool for pleasure, but in the hands of a true artist, it becomes an instrument of profound importance. I try to counsel the young students of photography along this line. Try to tell them what so many of you so well know, that photography is incredibly easy and impossibly difficult, that in the hands of a sensitive photographer, the camera becomes a vehicle for assessing and understanding our own culture, that the aspiring photographer should be a student of humanities. He must fill his life with more than just technical information about the inner working of the camera. It is far more important to know about the inner working of the human mind and soul, for the heart and the mind are the true lens of the camera. Mr. President, if we can view the slides, we're going to have fun now.
If you will bear with us for a moment, I just want to make certain that they are coming through in the other rooms.
I can tell you a very interesting story now that as a photographer, and I'm sure there are many young people who are photographers, you have to be sure that you don't give out anything that you will not be held responsible for in your life, even if it is 40 years after. This morning, a young lady brought me a photograph, a very distinguished guest here tonight. He was taking part with a lady in a role in a Shaw play, Back to Methuselah. And his name was the very Honorable Jack Klein. And his lady, who ultimately became Mrs. Klein. And they brought me this photograph for confirmation. Well, I have not seen that. This was taken the first 3 months of my life in Ottawa, my career. And it really stood well because I was groping then. I was trying, I was experimenting. But that photograph saved the day for me. I was glad to see it and confirm it.
I understand we're coming through in all the rooms except the lobby, think we might...
It's now working in the lobby.
Is it now working in the lobby? Thank you. I think we might proceed in that case.
Well, we'll speak about the photograph in the center. I never realized that this institution was so rich in its facilities that I curtailed the number of slides I brought with me, and I assumed we'll view them one at a time. Then ultimately, in having a few minutes rehearsal yesterday, we decided in favor of showing the three together. So that these are the men who landed on the moon, Neil Armstrong, Aldrin, and Michael Collin. And I hope it is not lack of appreciation of accomplished men and women that we become so sophisticated, we easily forget previous achievement. And before making this photograph of the three people together, which is a tough, difficult picture to make of three men together, because they were striking a medal from this, I merely asked people passing in the corridor in NASA if they'll do me the pleasure of assisting me to pose for the stars. and I worked very hard experimenting, balancing my life and three young people of equal age. And after we finished, I thanked them very much. They shook hands with me. They said, Mr. Karsh, we hope when we are famous, you'll give us the pleasure of photographing us. And they were all, to my shame, were all previous astronauts. So Neil Armstrong proved to be a charming person. And immediately after we finished, he took my wife's arm and myself. He said, there is a little club here. We'll go and have lunch. And he kept on bombarding my wife and myself. Tell us something about Canada. Tell us something about Africa, about Italy, about France. You've been in all of these. So my wife said, but Neil, you've just come to the moon. Why are you interested in these mundane things? Well, he replied with complete sincerity and innocence, said, but that's the only place I have been to. Well, we have all read the work of Hemingway, and we imagined him as an adventurer. But actually, this photograph was made in Havana, and I did my homework very well, a little too well, unfortunately, because I was told, in essence, he will not be impressed if you tell him you've read some of his work, because he's come to take it for granted. But if you learn to appreciate and drink, his favorite cocktail, daiquiri, then you've made it. So we arrived there, and my Canadian ambassador and the American ambassador, the last American ambassador in Havana, Gardner, had arranged with Hemingway to phone him and take me there. So we left there about 8:45. And they had a few words of pleasantry, and they left me. They said, Karsh, you carry on with Ernest and arrange for a mutually convenient time for you. So Ernest Hemingway went to the kitchen and shouted, Karsh, what will you have to drink? I said, daiquiri. He said, good God, at this hour of the day? So we could sometimes over-prepare. And often, while I'm at this subject, we must realize that all these men and women of achievement, all these men who are in the public eye, all these people who are interested in their fellow man, they are in the habit of giving much of themselves. So don't burden yourself. Concentrate on the task at hand. Well, I see the next picture is that of the last great portrait painter, Auguste John. He was a very admirable and free spirit. I think he was the president of, what is that troop of men and women who are nomad? What is the word? Auguste John was the men and women who live out of doors all the time, stay out of doors. Gypsies. Well, you don't expect the president of the university to know that, do you? So, Auguste John, I had admired him very much, and he had very distinct opinions, and we will deal with it when I see Shaw's photograph, maybe.
Without the light
for 10 minutes. Oh, well, I'm sorry about that. We have to switch it off. You mean it has... Are you that timid that you did not call it to our attention? Then next, please, sir.
You could put your light on.
Thank you. Then we have Shaw. Well, now, Shaw, I went in 1943 to photograph him, and he was very inaccessible. But ultimately, through the help of very outstanding Canadian, Leonard W. Brockington and Lady Astor, they made a rendezvous for me. But I insisted in his case that I would like to visit and see the place where I photographed him. So I was faced with his appallingly competent secretary, Blanche Patch. And without even saying how do you do, she said, Mr. Shah will be photographed right in this fireplace. And you will have 5 minutes and you can only use small camera. I said, why the fireplace? She said, that is how where he's photographed all of the time. Well, I said, do you think we can strike a little change for a change? So suddenly the great man came out, and at that tender age of over 80, he was shuffling his way towards you. He said, I heard your conversation with Miss Patch. I must support her. She is absolutely right. No more than 5 minutes. So I said, sir, may I ask if the world should ask you to write your best play and insist that you seal your lips and tie your hands behind your back, what kind of a play will you give them? He said, may I ask what nationality are you? I said, Armenian, sir. He said, ah, but you know, the only way to keep the Armenians healthy and strong is to have them exterminated once in a while. But do not misunderstand this, really. This was, he always accustomed to playing the role of the picador. He just wanted to say that because he's known where one of the celebrated poet, really gifted poet, died almost unknown. He said something so critical about him that he was criticized. But he said, if I had not opened my mouth, probably we would never have read his poetry on the front pages of the paper. So finally, he said, why do you want to photograph me? I said, it's for the Canadian government archive. And this will interest Mr. Arnold Smith very much. He said, since when the Canadian government know a good picture when they see one? He said, of course, if they want to be sure that the work of art is good, they should ask Auguste John to paint me. He said, no, I take that back, because Auguste John has painted me a number of times, but regrettably, they all look as if I, Shaw, take spirits. But ultimately, I received the coveted postcard receiving the great Irish wit approval that this was one of his favorite photographs. And when I met him for the second time, he congratulated me, but he said, still, the best likeness I have ever seen of myself is when I look in a looking glass. Thank you, sir. We have Castro. This was a very interesting experience to go and expect to photograph the revolutionary person. And to my delight, he was only interested, he had seen my books, and he was only interested in the writers and artists I had photographed. Camus, tell me something about him. Ernest Hemingway, whom he knew personally. Jean-Louis Barrault, Jouvet, ever so many. And we passed very pleasant 3.5 hours. So finally he said, where is your wife? She was also invited. I said, Mr. President, my wife is American citizen. He said, since when we have anything against the Americans? It is Nixon that I do not like. But before I left, I said, with your indulgence, I think I have no role in politics whatsoever, but I think it is totally unnatural to be so close to the United States and not by now have a rapport. May I have your approval if I show these photographs? Hopefully they'll be successful to show them to some of the leaders. And the first person I had to show them was to our own Secretary of State in Ottawa, Edgar Ritchie. And with his full approval, again, Castro's approval, I showed them to Kissinger. And I had a 25 variety, impressive picture of this extraordinary, charismatic figure. And the ultimate conclusion was, you are absolutely right, Kash. As soon as we finish with this mess of Vietnam, we have to do something about rapport and meeting of mind with Cuba. For if we cannot love each other, we should at least learn to live with each other. Well, we have three extraordinary ladies, Martha Graham. And from the photographer's point of view, I had seen her the night before, and she's an exquisite choreographer and dancer. This was taken some years ago. But then ultimately, when the next day I went to her home, I discovered that the ceilings were very low. And for a dancer, this is catastrophic. So happily, I gave her a little low bench, and she sat on it. And being the great artist she is, she kept on going through the emotion, and I was able to record it. And I don't mind it looking like a mask of this great choreographer, because she is really very austere in her interpretation and her choreography, but very inspired. Anna Magnani in Italy, although as unique an actress she was, and I remember, if I'm not mistaken, either it was specially written for her by Jean Cocteau, or at least she did it sublimely. It was a 45-minute solo acting of Jean Cocteau's work, La Voix Humaine. And she took me to see it, and this tears your heart from sheer emotion, the many parts she was able to act. But above all this artistic success, she was the saddest woman, because her son John, the only child, was a victim of polio. What a pity that he was just born a little too soon for that. The other lady is Joan Baez. This was during that no longer fashionable practice of universities. It was taken during their protests. And she had gotten up that very early morning. She had a word that they will burn libraries and attack the faculties and all that. So she got up early and marshaled the help of some of her colleagues, the faculty member, and they all spoke on the loud speaking system that you are in a university to be civilized, and such behavior is not condoned anymore. But try to be intelligent and express your desire. And if it has any basis of fact, if it's constructive, you will find you listen to. And she came back, she was exhausted, to her home. She said, "May I have a little sleep?" And with her clothes on, she went right on the chair and went sound asleep. Ultimately, she refreshed herself, and I was out for a walk. I brought in this little lilac from the ground, and we... In the meantime, she was so very busy that her child didn't see her at all, an infant child. But she made sure that now and then her aunt, who acted as a guardian and a nanny, put on the voice of the mother, and singing lullabies, as well as familiarizing his hearing with the voice of her, of his gifted mother. We have Eleanor Roosevelt, photographed in the White House, and she was so extraordinarily animated that I photographed her hands while she was visiting, while she was talking, and also her face. And this is the combination of both. But when it appeared in Life magazine, it was very welcomed, for they featured an entire page of different attitudes of her hands and a portrait of this portrait. So I told her that what a difficulty I had persuading the secretaries to bring this little L-shaped chair on you, for you to put your hands on, because I was told that Mrs. Roosevelt never used this chair. Well, she said he'll never be able to say that again after this occasion. Marian Anderson, we all know the legendary accomplishment of this black lady. You remember she was refused to speak in front of Lincoln Memorial in Washington. And when Mrs. Roosevelt heard, no, excuse me, in one of the national historic places where artists usually sing. But because she is black, she was not allowed to sing there. So Mrs. Roosevelt invited her to sing in front of Lincoln Memorial. And when she visited the great Sibelius in Finland, he very politely ordered, "Please give us some cake and coffee." And then she said, "May I sing for you?" He said, "Please do." And the moment he heard the first note, he said, "Champagne, please." The rain is... This will please the ladies, the young ladies here. This is a triumph over first impression. When I first met Grace Kelly, Princess Rainier at the time, on Fifth Avenue in her home, she had her hair in curls. And that you can either attribute it to extra amount of self-confidence or negligence. And happily, as she came to speak with me, she started the comb and throwing all these miserable pins away. And she was like a little goddess, beautiful. And this picture was struck, they struck stamp of it, and it was on the cover in color of Look magazine. This was one of the many series I had the pleasure of doing, not only a series on Vancouver through its people for Maclean magazine some years ago, but also this man, whose name has escaped me, unfortunately, had been flown in a helicopter by the Canadian government to be brought to Edmonton Camsel's Hospital to be operated on for cataract. So his name was on his lapel, Daniel, and his all worldly belonging in that white bag. Happily, he was well, and I sent him this photograph as a souvenir shortly after that. And the other lady was, at that time, we still called them Eskimos. She was in the hospital in bed. And look at that serene, beautiful face. Oh. And then we have Bibi, Brigitte Bardot, whom by sheer coincidence I flew from photographing Pope John the 23rd to France to photograph. And Brigitte Bardot said, "Is it true that you just came back from photographing His Holiness?" I said, "Yes." "Ah," she said, "from the saints to the sinners." But she's absolutely brilliant and very interesting and extremely intelligent. With all this, that endowment. Well, as we all have heard of the large format Polaroid camera, this was taken of Arthur Fiedler on 8x10. And I have been after Dr. Land for some time to give us a possibility of large format. But suddenly, he invites me about 16 months ago to be present to introduce me to what he treated with a great mystery and suspense, and he had reason to. He said, "Will you settle not only for 8x10, but I can give you 20x24 inches Polaroid." And I went up. He had three illustrious people present, and over 2 days I photographed them. One of them was Arthur Fiedler, then the president of MIT, and their own chairman of the board, McDougall. So after arranging everything, it is really quite thrilling to know that we are living in such exciting era that they peel this large format and you have this exquisitely subtle print in color. And this will satisfy the snob of the world, because they hold photography as victim for its own virtue, because I can give you an original photograph and your brother and sister can have also an original photograph. It is less valuable if we knew there is only one of its kind. So that will please that individual. And I think in due course, it will be very permanent. As yet, it is very experimental yet. So I expect that I will never work as hard as I do now. Because if Land wants me to operate that large camera, I'll have to have six people traveling with me, and I'll just take the glory for it. Prince Charles. I asked specifically to photograph Prince Charles when he was last at Government House in a plain open shirt. And so he surprised me also by bringing a bit of the influence of Lord Mountbatten, Safari quote. And so at a certain moment, I reminded Prince Charles that I had the pleasure of photographing him last when he was 3 years of age, and that I had stopped in New York to pick up small toys to entertain the royal children after photographing their father and mother, just to have rapport with the child. I said, you had just entered from the garden and you had a little daisy in your lapel. And before you accepted my gift, you had the left hand on the toy and the right hand on the daisy to give it to me in exchange. He said, was I really that well brought up? In the center is Canon Magnusson, our wonderful world skater. And at the time, this was also done on Polaroid. I took her to George Stavropoulos and had this magnificent chiffon gown, salmon color. And 23rd has given you the longest possible audience, but please do not make this fact known to any of the ambassadors. And it was, he was amused because there was a headline newspaper, "The Pope in Prison." What happened was he realized that on a sacred day, on a feast day, that all those prisoners in jail, he wanted to visit them. So he asked the help of nuns to prepare food and go and see them. And he greeted them. He said, I inquired into your case very seriously, and I realized as you could not all of you come and visit me, I decided to come and visit you. And so the hands that are accustomed to tender and merciful service were serving the jailers, and there was no security and no violence. That is beautiful. And the last picture was the last photograph of Pope John some 2 years after. How long did he present? Nearly 4 years. What? Yes, 3.5 years after. Life magazine had, this is again for the interest of photographers, they had already committed themselves to having a horizontal two-page spread in Life magazine. And they wanted to have, they must have a color, and the person that was much in the news because he was gravely ill was Pope John the 23rd. So I went over, and the answer was no, too ill. So I sent my assistant back with all the equipment. And suddenly, Saturday night at 2 o'clock in the morning, someone phoned me, a priest. He said, I think we'll be able to make it. So I borrowed a Hasselblad wide angle lens and one flash, and I went there, and I was lucky enough to get this picture during an audience, and they made their picture. It's just a snapshot, but very significant from life point of view. Thank you. Dr. Cellier, it was during clinic in Montreal, and for you who are so happy in being at this distinguished university, let me give you a little warning which Cellier himself would give you, that stress can be the result of excessive sorrow and excessive happiness. So if it is the latter, be careful. Zulu lady, their faces fascinated me, their grace, and this is one of them, a mother and child. And the other lady, there is a natural nobility about her as she walks in that status symbol, a blanket, by her crawl. And a little bit for Peter Lougheed's Calgary Stampede. We have an amusing study, one of my early photographs. As I visited Manhattan, I was fascinated at night about these canyons around me. And so I came back, I took a box of soda fountain straws, and I put a spotlight on it, and gives you the impression a bit of Manhattan flooded at night. Dr. Michael DeBakey, that is quite an experience. I often marvel at the dexterity and the perfection and the dedication of this doctor. I saw him operate 2-3 times arterial surgery, and in this case, he would the patient will be probably a blue baby, and the patient will be body child of 7 years of age, absolutely blue, and within a few minutes, the miracle has taken place, place. He has bypassed, and the flow of pure blood has gone to his heart. And it's very impressive. His hands, the baker's hands. Thank you. Jacques Cousteau, how much civilization the world owes him. He's trying to salvage the sea for us through his program of ecology. But often people say, ah, that is the nose I have wanted to be born with. And Sir Alexander Fleming in the center with the original mold of penicillin taken in St. Mary's Hospital in London. He is a very beloved physician, scientist, and more recently, my wife, because she is a medical writer and historian, suggested that I prepare, in as much as I have photographed so many celebrated doctors throughout the world, how nice it will be if we make a portfolio and present it to Harvard Medical Library, that is the Countway Library, which is the custodian of all the treasure of Harvard and the Boston Medical Library. And I don't want to be for certain, but I think we discovered that although they had this great treasure, the fire insurance was not adequate. So they said, let us put 12 pictures together and donate it to Harvard, have it beautifully printed in Switzerland, and that people cannot buy this, but they can send $500 or more and acquire this 12 photographs of famous physicians. And it has proven to be very, very interesting. But the research work that my wife, Spirita, did was fascinating because she studied their work, she looked after, she studied their writing, and came about with one significant quotation which symbolizes their work. And let me, with your indulgence, quote you two, three of these 12. Alexander Fleming, it, penicillin, arrived nameless and numberless. All I did was to notice it. Albert Einstein, we put him there because of his obvious influence on all phases of our life. And he says here, curiosity has its own reason for existence. Never lose a holy curiosity. And Helen Keller, we put her there because she is a healer of the spirit. Faith is the strength by which a shattered world shall emerge into the light. And Albert Schweitzer, at the entrance of his jungle hospital in La Barenne, here, at whatever hour you come, you will find light and help and human kindness. So that portfolio has given us a great deal of satisfaction and pleasure. The other is our own Canadian doctor, gynecologist at the John Hopkins Hospital, Dr. Tom Collins. Well, perhaps the one aside of his unique achievement, he worked until the age of 80, operated, but he also wrote a copious book of some 900 pages on the belly button. Bertrand Russell, both in portrait, and he had was still insisting in listening to his master's voice, an old Victrola, an old Victor speaker in front of him. So I couldn't resist the temptation, like all amateur photographers make experiments, so I photographed him in a silhouette as well. And one of my favorite photographs, François Mauriac, the Catholic writer, the pessimistic Catholic writer, we moved in, this was in 1946 in Paris, and he lived on the sixth floor, only to our chagrin that the elevator was not working. There was electrical cutout. So I, with my help, we went up sixth floor and set up the equipment and waited, no light. Ultimately, in sheer desperation, after some hours, I felt, well, I better tend something before the natural light of the room disappears. So there are those noble French windows, high French windows. I borrowed a sheet, a white sheet from the housekeeper, and I had someone hold it just to fill in a little shadows, and we have this exquisite pencil drawing of light on his face. And I'm glad my lights did not work. John F. Kennedy, this was rather extraordinary. This often happens. I was asked by Life to go and photograph Lyndon Johnson as the, and President Kennedy, President-elect. So I had already photographed John F. Kennedy several times, but he said, I know Lyndon has a very much larger room. You set up in his room, I'll come to you. And when he came, he said, is it going to be in color as well? Well, he said, when then we're going to exchange ties. So he asked mine a tie, and we very ceremoniously put each other's tie on. Foolishly enough, I returned his tie afterwards. But as he was as we were working in front of a desk, then the tall Texan Lyndon Johnson came in. And immediately, the young president did this, and he was listening to his vice president-elect on some political matters. And I clicked the picture. And it was within a few months after that, short fly after that, history is well known to you now. Picasso, a very extraordinary, restless experimentalist, he did everything in every process so well. But this second picture with the vase, I only published recently in my current book, and to my amazement, someone from New York called, he said, I have that very vase. I said, well, you have more courage than I did, because I desired that vase too, but I didn't have the courage to ask him if I may acquire it. However, he said, I would like very much to have that photograph. And do you suppose it will be incongruous if you also photograph me with it? Well, the two don't look alike, but it was done. Thank you. Next, sir. Her Majesty and Prince Philip, this was taken for the centennial celebration of Canada. We have another one. Oh, Sibelius. No, Albert Schweitzer. Well, Albert Schweitzer, I spent 2 days with him. It was a great satisfaction. He had the power of concentration. He was writing constantly, and every time we made a break, he said, if you want to have a little rest or further rest, I'll go on. And he went back to his studies, to his writing, which he did all by freehand, as if nothing had happened. And then we had breakfast together and lunch. Then I happened to comment on the coffee served at his table. He said, you are very observant. This coffee was hanging in Equatorial Africa in muslin for some 3 years. It's dry, it's beautiful, and we roast it freshly every time. He said, any coffee drunk younger than 3 years is toxic. After 3 years is beneficial. And the great Sibelius, this was a very moving experience as when I was photographing the Dean of Music in Great Britain, Ralph Vaughan Williams, I jubilantly told him I'm going to Helsinki to photograph Sibelius. And he, with a great gesture, he took one of his symphony and dedicated to Schweitzer, to Sibelius. Then when I made known my delight to our High Commissioner at Canada House, Wilgris, he gave me a beautiful bottle of old cognac, because he knew Sibelius liked cognac, and a box of cigars. Then others gave me letters of introduction. Well, the warmth of his welcome was such that I only present him all this the second day. But as he sat by the piano talking, I reminded him also that during the Finnish Russian war, we have great many Canadians, Finnish Canadians, in the Lakeheads district, that their cutting of wood, the timber, was at a very high peak when Finland was winning, but it went diminished completely at once when the Russians start winning. And the director of the camp decided to put on Finlandia, and at once the production increased. And so his eyes became moist, he closed his eyes, and this is the picture. The three great, no, I see, all right. Albert Einstein. I don't think there is much to say about him, no use. All right, we'll go on to Frank Lloyd Wright, the architect, the great American architect in the center. I have long been convinced that men were more vain than others, men more vain than women. And this is not apocryphal at all, it's a true story. On one occasion, Frank Lloyd Wright had to defend himself in court, but the lawyer told him, it would be a dangerous premises for you to defend yourself, let me do it for you. He said, no. So his lawyer accompanied him, and the court reminded him that he's under oath. Your name, sir, Frank Lloyd Wright. Your profession, architect, sir. Your honor, correction, the greatest architect ever lived. So his lawyer afterwards said, you know, Frank, why, we all know you are ahead of your century by 50 years, by half a century. Why don't let others say you are the greatest? He said, look, I was under oath. And while I'm at that subject, we have more than our share of vanity among our men, our brilliant men. One of them is our own Canadian, John Kenneth Galbraith, where I reminded him at the Boston Symphony, at the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, that he will be one of the 125 personages being exhibited there. So he sent me a telegraph, he was in Europe, he said, I would have been with you if only to discover who the other 124 famous people are. And the other, of course, Luke, Mies van der Rohe. And we now have, on this side, Le Corbusier. So you have really the three greatest revolutionists in architecture in the world of the mid-20th century. And now we have artists here, Max Ernst, with his sculpture, which is a self-portrait, and Miro with his whimsical drawing in the center. Thank you, sir. Our own Jean-Paul Riopel, who had to go to France to receive recognition before he's appreciated elsewhere, but he's a very gifted Canadian artist. Who does both sculpture now and painting. This is on my extreme right, Jean-Paul Riopel. Giacometti was photographed just 2 weeks before he died, unbeknown to me that he was in advanced case of cancer. And to my, it has often happened when I photograph very well-known people that they become intolerant and insufferable when photographing them. Then I have learned never to be disturbed about that. Invariably there is excessive pain, and great men do not wish to exhibit pain in public. And Henry Moore. This is the fun I'm now having. Doing a series for the National Ballet of Canada. So we have on the extreme right, Karen Kane. You recall that Nureyev, some 5 years ago, selected her as his companion. But to see this young lady dance today, she is growing a statue in front of your eyes. She's so fine as she projects herself. And this was multiple images which I used, and her jumping in the center as a flower. And this will be part of a portfolio for as a fundraising for the National Ballet in Toronto to celebrate their 25th anniversary. Now we have Nadia Potts in the center. They have such opulent setting that I was tempted to photograph her in the classical manner, and she's a lovely little dancer. And the other is just the two young children among 40 new students for their first week at a school of the ballet. You know, they don't take them younger than 10 years. And when they came out of 40, as I observed them, I chose two young girls to complicate my life. The names of these two young ladies are Eva and Ava, and I still don't know which is which. This is Nureyev. Again, he's in support of the National Ballet of Canada, because he has adopted that ballet. And he was photographed after an inspired presentation of Sleeping Beauty in Montreal a few months ago. And every member of the National Ballet, Court Ballet, danced their sublime best. So much so, the press in Montreal praised Nureyev's dancing, but they said, our own Karen Kane danced even better. So it was rewarding. However, it was as a personage I photographed Nureyev, and this mischievous attitude in front of his face, which you see. I told him that now you have just finished acting in the role of the greatest lover of the 20th century. Let me see those mischievous, those sensuous lips of yours. So this is how he showed them. And then as he put on his cap to leave, I said, I want another one of you. He looked so elegant. So suddenly his aide, his valet gave him this mirror, and we have another extraordinary picture of him. Finally, he said, are you satisfied? I said, well, I am, but I'm going to have difficulty in telling the world that I have photographed the foremost male dancer in the world, and he behaved like an angel. Nobody will believe me, because he used to be insufferable, arrogant fellow trotting on the stage as recent as 5 years ago. Now his English is more perfect, he's more sure of himself, and people are holding with great affection. Norman Mailer. It's rather delightful to see how he has the reputation of being the enfant terrible, but he came to meet us at a rendezvous when we drove down to his home, and he said, I hope the Karshas have time to have dinner with me tonight. I will cook it. So I warned him. I said, my wife is allergic to everything. I made it, his task very difficult. He said, I'm equal to it. So that evening he cooked two dinners, and my wife enjoyed it very much. And so thoughtfully, before we took our leave late in the evening, he drove about some 20 miles ahead of us to see that we are on the right route going back to New York. My beloved Canadian, and that's Bruce Hutcherson. And he's here, and I'm just delighted. And I cannot help but, I hope he will not be disapprove of this. In his book, The Far Side of the Street, Bruce Hutcherson tells a story about my unswerving dedication to photography. I read in part, assuming that Wilson was the hired camp roustabout, a natural mistake, Yusuf Karsh briskly ordered him to act as a stand-in for photographic composition and to hose down the arbutus trees and make them glisten for background effect. Wilson obeyed these commands without a word, and not until the pictures were finished did I reveal his identity. Whereupon Yusuf, a gentleman of sensitive manners, could think of nothing to say and drowned his confusion by plunging fully clothed into the lake. The Chief Justice remarked only that he would take the cash and let the credit go. There is, however, a memorable precedent to this occasion when I had the honor of photographing His Majesty King George VI during the war in 1941-43. I did not wish to have this austere, serene figure against any ornate background. So I had with me two Canadian Army privates, strong Army private, and I decided to borrow an army blanket from Buckingham Palace to hang it up. And we rehearsed this after we had to get approval first if we could pin it onto the wall. And the two army private kept on slipping completely. So suddenly I found the king turning his back to us, holding it with his both hands for the two strong army, Canadian army to pin it. So much for the hewers of wood and the carriers of water. Who have we there, sir? The next one is Muhammad Ali. It is not, it's a sheer coincidence that Muhammad Ali is next to Bruce Hutchinson, because these were to view individually, but the greatest applies. He came in a, this was before his return to boxing a few years ago. It was taken for Look magazine, but he came in a banker's suit. And how prophetic it was. And there is a great nostalgia today to the past photographs of stars. And this is Boris Karloff, and we'll view some others. Peter Lorre and Humphrey Bogart. And Tennessee Williams. Thank you, sir. That's all. Now, when I was in Japan to assist the Japanese government to establish a photographic show for their Expo 70, they asked for my show to be exhibited there. And I told them it would be perhaps more complete if I could photograph some of their luminaries to be part of this show so that the people will identify with them. So they produced 12 illustrious names, mostly Nobelists, writers, physicists, ceramists, etc., producers, cinema actors, etc. And in the center is the physicist Tomonaga. And the other is Kawabata, their foremost writer, perhaps the Hemingway of Japan, who received the Nobel Prize for Literature in 1968. And they have a most happy faculty. Here in Canada, we honor people, we recognize them with the Splendid Order of Canada. In Japan, they designate them for life as the living human treasure. And these 12 people I photographed were living human treasure. But we spoke about doctors, and the other was a collection of my photographs, the idea of an advertising agency in support of the muscular dystrophy. They gathered all these photographs, and they were very widely used, supported by magazine and newspaper, all published for nothing as their contribution towards the progress of raising funds for the muscular dystrophy. And inasmuch as in my lifetime I have been privileged to photograph Alexander Fleming, who gave us penicillin, Banting and Best, who gave us insulin, Salk's vaccine, it is the hope that also in my lifetime we can fill in that space by photographing the discoverer for this dreadful muscular disease. On the right is my first photograph, journalistic photograph, took place during the visit of a president of the United States in office to Canada. This was on the terrace of Quebec Citadel. And it was there that I first met Mackenzie King, and he made the understatement of the century by saying, I'm the Prime Minister of Canada. If I can be of any help to you, don't hesitate. And he was as good as his word. This shows President Roosevelt with his son James and that extraordinary man, John Buchan, Lord Tweedsmuir. And then Dr. Oppenheimer, during his saddest experience when he was being tortured by the politicians, of being accused of being anti-American and communist. And I think the figure, the lonely figure, shows it. And the other is Jelena, taken some years ago when there was the assumption that the French Canadian were treated as a second-class citizen, and this act was all supplication and appeal and pleading. But that no longer has to be a reason, because recently it has been my pleasure to photograph many artists in Quebec City as well as in Montreal. And I can do a whole building on this lively, active, brilliant, young French-speaking artist. They are really of international rank, and not necessarily because they happen to be French living in Quebec. In the center, Carl Jung, whose 100th years of his birth we celebrated last year. The other is Chagall, and the other Ravi Shankar. Thank you. David Lowe, the cartoonist, whom Hitler referred to as that man, Lowe knows what I'm thinking tomorrow today. And the glorious composer, violinist, George Enesco, and Sir Laurence Olivier. Pablo Casals, in addition to this unusual approach, I happened to ask Casals, who was really a very great humanitarian and great musicologist and inspired cellist, I said, which are the two happiest moments in your life, sir? He said, oh, gosh, it will take books to tell you that. But let me tell you the two saddest experiences of my life, my two saddest regrets. Firstly, that I have no children of my own. And secondly, although I lived very close, within accessible distance to Brahms, I did not go out of my way to meet him. Robert Frost, he was pointing a finger at Canada being a good neighbor make good fences. And Andre Malraux, an extraordinary conversationalist, he stuttered. But you recall that he is a brilliant writer, explorer, and patriot. And when de Gaulle came into power, he commissioned him to clean all the cathedrals. He took charge, and he had many of the major reproduction of the work of art in the Louvre made available, extraordinary good quality, for anyone to buy for very little. And I happened to comment that when I saw him a second time and took this picture to him, that the Cambodian sculptor, which is on a stand there beside him, the nose of this ancient work looks exactly like the nose of Andre Malraux. Well, he said that's to be it's understood, because all discoverers end up looking like their discovery, all with the exception of the statue of Victory. It has no head. Georgia O'Keeffe, the extraordinary women painter, which prompted her husband, who was the first man to acknowledge photography and exhibit it as a work of art. He said, at last we have a women painter. And it was way back 75 years ago where he exhibited photographs beside paintings. And it is a result of Alfred Stieglitz, her husband, that photography enjoying this tremendous acceptance and gives so much pleasure. Khrushchev, do we still have time, Mr. President, or are we talking too long?
I think it would be quite appropriate
well,
to continue.
I can only say this. I'll cut it briefly because this was thanks to a distinguished Canadian who's here tonight, Arnold Smith, who will be your next speaker next week. He was our ambassador to Canada. And when I received a word that I will photograph Khrushchev, I was asked to go to the Foreign Office and they bombarded me to question, why do you want to photograph Khrushchev? And how long would you want? Well, I told him that with De Gaulle I had half a minute, with John F. Kennedy 90 minutes, with Pope John 90 minutes, with others 2 days. I said, if you take the average of that, that's how long I will want with the chairman. So the next day he surprised me and he came with all of his family and grandchildren. And he was very punctual and they gave me the entire afternoon. But at once he told me, he said, let us consider this Canada Day, because today I have invited your ambassador, Arnold Smith, to visit without any restriction, to visit Siberia, and now you are photographing me. When I asked Khrushchev how he felt about the hotline between White House and the Kremlin, he said, I feel very good about it, but we need something more important than that, and that is meeting of minds. And finally, I said, Mr. Chairman, I would like to photograph you in a big fur coat. He said, why not? Already I had been refused by his wife and others because they said it was in a mothball. But he told me this was a fur coat reserved for foreign dignitaries. And the last one who wore it was Harold Macmillan. He said, it's so thick that if they should fall, we will not have a cause célèbre. They don't hurt themselves. And he said, you know, Harold Smith did fall. Harold Macmillan did fall. So finally I said, Mr. Chairman, while I'm here, I would like to photograph all the members of Presidium in Moscow. He delivered himself one of the most extraordinary lines. He said, in our system of government, this is a decision for the individual to make. By the following morning, 10 o'clock, the individual had decided. I was given 2 rooms in the Kremlin and we started photography. And he produced the first high official protocol, is very highly respected in the Kremlin. He produced Brezhnev. So suddenly I found myself telling Mr. Brezhnev, you must be a favorite son that the chairman gives me the honor of introducing me to you in person. Oh, he said, the chairman is very persuasive because he told me you'll make me look as good as you did Audrey Hepburn.
One more up here.
I commented on that. George O'Keefe.
We now have the serial ones.
Right, sir. Oh, they made a mistake. All right. Yes. All right. Right. We all know the story, and I will not deny it. But at a moment when this first photograph was taken, Mr. Churchill said, you may take another one. This time he stood straight, benign, and happy. And this is the second one. Now, we've had many comments about these photographs because I remember when I finished making this photograph, he extended his hand, shook my hand, and said, you can even make a roaring lion stand still to be photographed. But I like to remember the beautiful, eloquent tribute paid Churchill when Edward R. Morrow, the Anglophile commentator, American commentator, when he saw this photograph, he paid Churchill a most unique compliment. He said, ah, here is the man who marshaled the English language and sent it into battle when we had little else. And more recently, I was approached by different press when they destroyed the painting of Graham Sutherland who made of him. And my reply was, we are too close to history to determine the merit of any work of art. I did not believe in destroying anything. Then in my possession, there is a very rare disc, very rare record, the only one of its kind. It was lovingly prepared for me by Stuart Keat some years ago. And with Letha, he brought it to my home. It was extolling the accomplishment and virtue of Winston Churchill, and also hint on the humor and accomplishment of Winston Churchill. But he culminated with a rather personal note by saying, Yusuf, give me back my cigar and I will finish the job. Helen Keller, I always refer, and this is the last, I refer to her as the sublimest woman I've ever photographed. I remember Catherine Cornell and Martha Graham took me to photograph her, and they referred to this trio as the Three Musketeers. They loved each other, and I remember one instance, they told me that it will be very emotional to meet this lady, for she might place her fingers on your lips and are in your throat, and she feels the vibration of your speech. In essence, she is photographing you with her mind's eyes. And it was true, very emotional. So I find myself, I said, Miss Keller, it is not the first time I have the pleasure of meeting you. Of course, being translated by Polly Thompson, her second teacher, with their hands on a Braille book. I said, I have known you through your writing, and the first article I read in a popular magazine called, titled, How to Appreciate the Beauty of Sunset by Helen Keller. I said, now that I'm in your presence, I no longer associate you with sunset, but rather sunrise. To which Ms. Keller replied, how I wish the leaders of the world, the leaders in the United Nations, take that as their slogan, sunrise, and forget the shadows of sunset behind them. Thank you very much for the honor of listening.
Thank you very much. Would you still like to answer some questions?
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Karsh has indicated that, as is our tradition, he would be very pleased to entertain questions from the audience.
Yes?
Do you remember the description of that picture that you took with John Cameron, that one that one had to
do? I beg your pardon, I don't quite hear you, I'm sorry.
Can you remember the picture that you that you took with Brownie Cameron?
Yes. It is in my little book called In Search of Greatness. It's a landscape with the three children romping on a pile of hay. It was romantic. It looks like Corot, but as it should be, I was influenced very romantic at that time. My romance has taken different color and approach these days.
Mr. Karsh, what size camera do you use to take these photographs?
All right.
Could you repeat the question for the rest of the audience?
Yes. What size cameras do I use? That's a very good question, and I meant to cover it earlier. I have all cameras. I have the latest of Leica Flex R3. I have Hasselblad. I have 8x10 camera with different lenses from 90 millimeter to 14 inch with a reducing back where I want to make 4x5 on 8x10. But with all this sophisticated equipment, with this 20th century, I still insist and prefer to use large format. But don't do as I say, or as I do, because we have had great masterpiece of photography for the last 150 years taken with smaller cameras, and we are having masterpieces done every day and will continue to have them. The question is to use any camera where you can push it like a pencil. It all depends how well you want to write, which direction, and what you want to say. And while we're at it also, I use photographic paper. The professional photography world is very impoverished today. There isn't very fine quality paper in the world for photography anymore. They have concentrated on the effort of the amateurs, and it is very sad. However, we use what is available. I happen to be using Medalist J2, 3, whatever it may be. And we usually develop our films by inspection and not by time and temperature. How do we go about that? Because they are very sensitive. But Kodak has a desensitizer where you can take these films and make them less sensitive to light, so that after they are in developer, 5, 6 minutes, 7 minutes, depends on, you can examine by the human eye, because that way you can have your individual stamp on them, whether you want, and the quality you want. So much, I think, for the technicalities.
As an artist of photography, whose work do you admire?
As an artist of photography, whose work do I admire? Well, I admire a great deal of Henri Cartier-Bresson, Eugene Smith, Irving Penn, and some of Yusuf Karsh's. The use of color is satisfying. Well, I have been making the last 40 years, but in fairness, and I'm glad my wife is not here because she will not approve of my remark, but in fairness, I get greater satisfaction out of black and white, because I can read into it my emotion of this hour. Tomorrow I may feel differently. I will see something else and different in the black and white. The color is a positive statement. And also remember that the permanence of it is a nightmare to a conscientious photographer. We finish all the color prints, our dye transfer, and that they are as permanent as science has given us. But it's still a young art, and it is being improved upon all the time.
Will you tell us who took the picture on the front page of the Sun?
Yes. Well, his name was very boldly written under it. Mr. Keith? Ian Lindsay. Fine, as if I was giving him the name for the first time. I'm so proud of myself. Yes.
How many photographs do you take for every photograph that we see?
Well, how many photographs do I take every time from a sitting? Well, I think we generally accept that photographers have an insatiable appetite, and they will take as many as time permits. Certainly with De Gaulle, it was one negative. with Winston Churchill, it was two. But these are not ordinary mortals. with others, I think if you surpass the 12, either the subject is dead or the photographer. The question is about 8x10 Polaroid photography. Well, this is really the color process of the hour, not only is it hopefully steady in its dyes, but I cannot speak for facts because I think in a year or two it will be more reliable, but it's really magnificent. I like that process of Polaroid because it's very subtle. It is not garish as most other color processes. And they provide you with this film. You put it in a regular slide, but special slide made by Polaroid, in the view camera of your 8x10. And as I said, they are doing this because there is great desire to have color and to have it the only one of its kind. And as such, yes, but you had better not make mistakes, because if they are not very good, you are embarrassed more quickly than you would be otherwise.
Here.
Gustav, what would be your advice to young photographers in a few words?
Well, as Mr. Levesque said, he cannot be restricted to 30 seconds because it's not soap opera. But my few words would be, I think I hinted at it in my main text, that young students ought to be students of the humanities first. That if possible, to take up photography seriously, you can take it as a hobby before you have had your BA, but preferably when you have finished your formal education. Because the competition is great, and the more information you have, the more sensitive is your interpretation of the subject. So I would say, think before you click.
Techniques aside, how do you personally achieve rapport with your subject?
Well, that also I mentioned it in my text. If they are famous, we know enough about them. If they are less well known, we read their work. And if they are not famous, we ask information from their immediate family, who will fortify us with their eccentricity, their characteristic, their hobbies. And if you approach yourself, your profession, with dedication, with sincerity, I think that is half of the battle.
I think we might have three more questions, in fairness to our speaker.
I'd like to know how many languages.
I can, between my wife and myself, we can eat in seven languages. How many languages do I speak? But I personally speak French, Arabic, and sometimes I say unkind things in Turkish, but it doesn't hurt anybody's feeling.
You started out as an apprentice with another photographer, and you were given the chance by somebody to do so. And nowadays, what would you say to somebody who would like to learn the trade, but nobody wishes to talk to the person that comes to do it?
Well, I still believe in apprenticeship with a very fine artist. The only thing is to make yourself a nuisance enough where someone will accept you because you have conviction in your own talent, and hopefully, ultimately, you'll prove him to be right in his choice. What personalities do I like to photograph? Well, all the ones I wanted to photograph are dead now. The others are, I'm still young enough where I hope to catch up to them. But your point is very well taken. I missed out on Chairman Mao. He should have been photographed. And I wanted to photograph him because he exerted the greatest amount of good on the greatest number of people of the world. I wish in my lifetime I could have photographed Lenin as well, or Gandhi. But the rest, I think the greatest source of talent we now have are among the young musicians, writers, singers. The world is throbbing with this, but how creative they'll continue to be, that is too early to say.
As an Armenian, have you photographed any Armenians?
Yes. Cardinal Gajanian, who almost became a pope. I have photographed, for your benefit, Mikoyan, whom I reminded him that I had already, that when I met Mikoyan, I reminded him, he was very gracious to me. He said, I'm happy to meet a fellow Armenian who's reached the top of the ladder. So I looked into his liquid Armenian eyes. I said, well, you haven't done too badly yourself.
Ladies and gentlemen, Mr. Karsh is aware that there are a number of people who would like his signature on books and things of that sort, and has graciously indicated that after he has had a chance to meet with a few people, he will be available for a reasonable period of time to do that. I'd like to remind you, and he has already mentioned it, that our speaker next week will be Arnold Smith on Canada and world politics. And I would then like to call on President Douglas Kenney to thank Mr. Karsh on our behalf.
Thank you very much, Mr. Weber. I'd first like to thank Stuart Keith and his wife, the Vancouver Sun, for bringing such a very distinguished, internationally known photographer to the Vancouver Institute and to this university. I think the summit should be congratulated on picking such a student, a physician, if I may say so, sir, and a psychologist of humanity. And talking as one who has always enjoyed Mr. Karsh's photography, I do not wish to reiterate his talk tonight, other than recalling one other comment he made on another occasion, that he said at that time that the perfect photographic portrait has yet to be taken. I think tonight we would contradict him. His lecture tonight is perfection, and his portraits are perfection.